Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
I'm with Jim Pascoe Watson, who's a doctor. You're a GP. Yeah.
Right, yeah.
You are an accomplished broadcaster.
A novice.
But I had to say that. Of course I had to say that. He looks absolutely scared shitless. But anyway, we'll see how we get on. Yeah, just relax, be yourself. It would be absolutely fine.
Thank you.
So we've known each other. So Welcome to Just Not Good Enough, which
Thanks.
Is the podcast. I don't know if it's a podcast or a radio show, actually. I'm not sure which, but whatever it is, it's all to do with mental health at work and toxic behaviour and toxic cultures and all that sort of stuff. So you, as a doctor, you've seen that from the other side, haven't you?
Absolutely. And thanks for inviting me, because I feel quite passionately about this, and I think it's a really important subject.
Mm.
I can't pretend to be an expert. I'm no psychiatrist or psychologist or anything like that, but I do have a bit of experience in terms of general practice.
Yeah. And the NHS.
And the whole NHS. And I think perhaps have a unique aspect to it, in that I've helped to care for and support people with mental health problems,
Yeah. But
also seen how mental health problems can show themselves within the NHS and within organisations. So it's just my sort of personal views, opposed to saying
you're not an expert is actually wrong, isn't it?
Right.
So anyway, look, before we get, we're going to get onto all of that in a minute. How long have we known each other now? It must be 20 years, is it?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Because
our kids,
really, through children at school,
yeah,
and the same sort of ages,
yeah,
and sports and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lately, actually, it's funny, lately we've been out for a couple of beers and a meal.
Indeed.
With our respectives.
Lovely.
And yeah, it was quite good, actually, wasn't it?
Really nice,
yeah,
to
I enjoyed
catch
it.
Up.
Although I think I paid, but anyway, you know, never mind. We won't go into that. So you are a GP, you're now retired,
yeah,
which, congratulations.
Thank you, 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I didn't know it was that soon.
Yeah.
Just introduce yourself, you know, who are you, what do you do? Well, you don't do very much now, but what did you do, and why medicine?
Okay, so I'm Jim Pascoe Watson. I'm now 59.
You're the first person to have given away their age.
I've been a GP. Well, you could probably calculate it, but I've been a GP. I joined the NHS 36 years ago. I've been a GP in my practice for 31 years, the last few of which was as the senior partner.
I didn't know that. Senior partner. Wow.
Well, I mean, it's a sort of hierarchical system in the NHS,
yeah,
which is something I'll come on to probably, because
yeah,
that's quite an important issue. Although we try to avoid it being hierarchical in our particular practice. And I've been a trained GPs for the last 20, 25 years.
Still doing it?
Well, now that I've retired. So I retired from the partnership a year ago, and then I continued to work as a locum for the practice just a couple of days a week for the past year.
Didn't you do a COVID jab session?
Yes, yes. So I'm trying to help out as much as I can, and that sort of thing. And I'm also the race course doctor at Cheltenham Racecourse. And I try and do other sort of associated things, and just to keep my hand in other aspects.
Is that for the horses or the jockeys?
It's for the crowd.
It's for the public, right, okay, fair enough.
And they're far more troublesome than the horses and the jockeys put together.
I can believe that, yeah.
Yes, and so obviously I've come across lots of mental health issues throughout my career, really, and have also been aware of how it can affect colleagues and staff, and how that affects the NHS as well, which is quite interesting.
That is interesting, because there's a relatively short period in the NHS, yes,
yeah,
and then you moved into general practice. Why did you do that? Is that because,
well,
you felt you were nearer the front line, or?
Yeah, I mean, the training in medicine is quite generic at the beginning, and often people know exactly what they want to go into, and they sort of focus on that quite early on. But as the training is generic, you do various specialties 6 months in each area, and I tended to find that each time I moved to a new area, I thought, oh, this is interesting, I could do this, and then I moved on to the next one, I thought, oh, this is interesting, I could do this. And so it then transpired. It's a bit of a jack of all trades, and I'd be the first to say master of none. But I think that's part of what being a GP is.
It is,
and it's partly about the communication and the family medicine and the looking after people for a longer period of time. So As a hospital consultant, I think people find that although you might be under a consultant's care for quite a long time, it usually is just for one episode of care, whereas general practice, as we often put it, it's cradle to the grave.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
when you've been in the same practice for 30 plus years, you then see generations of families coming through, which is fantastic.
But you get to know them, don't you? You
absolutely.
Get to know their idiosyncrasies, their habits, their illnesses, their
everything.
And I think
that's so important as well, and also their illness behaviour, how they react to ill health, and indeed their mental health. And that sort of knowledge and feeling that that you're their doctor, as it were, adds to an awful lot of the trust in primary care that then enables you to have a much better relationship with the patient.
So do you, just another occasion where I've lost my train of thought. So you're never off though, are you, as a doctor? Because I remember we went to the theatre and I can't remember what the hell we were seeing, and a woman collapsed, right? And I nudged your elbow and you shot out and dealt with her, and
they stopped me at the exit and pushed me back in. And
yes, yeah. Who the hell are you? But you looked after her. I think you missed the second half as
yes,
well. So
I
do you feel that
yeah.
sense of duty?
That keeps happening to me. I have a reputation for being a bit of a magnet for that sort of thing.
Well, I never want to see you again.
And yes, you are sort of always on. And interestingly, at the beginning of my career, I was acutely aware of that in our local community because I live within my practice area. And I was quite aware of the fact that if I was walking up and down the road, everybody knew who I was rather than me knowing who they were.
Yeah.
And you feel you have to be on your best behaviour, etc.
That's a bit restrictive.
And it can be sometimes. But actually, as time goes on and you become more confident in your abilities, as it were, that becomes a positive and you feel very much part of the community, and that's lovely. These things are much more difficult these days, and I think that the current generation of general practitioners and doctors aren't able to experience that quite the same way as I was.
Well, you go back to when I was a kid, well, you were a kid, you know, the doctor used to come round, you know, he had a sore throat, they'd come round and stick a thermometer in your mouth and all that sort of thing. You don't get any of that now.
You don't, and actually, if you look at that and how efficient that was in terms of time and
or inefficient,
workload and that sort of thing, it was a ridiculous thing to be doing.
Yeah.
And sometimes pendulums swing too far the other way, and now home visits are very infrequent,
yeah.
and perhaps there's a happy medium in between, because it is important, I think, to see the environment in which people are living, because that informs how they deal with their health as well. And so I think home visits can be a useful tool, but it takes a long time. And you can see four or five other patients in the time it takes to go out to surgery and see
or more,
see a patient.
Actually. Am I right? You only get 10 minutes per patient,
10 minutes
generally.
Per consultation, if it's a face-to-face consultation. That's telephone consultations are even quicker than that sometimes. And I think that this is one of the things that is impacting on that doctor-patient relationship, which I value so much, in terms of far more use of telephone, online consultations, etc., means that knowledge of your own doctor is fading a little, which I think is a shame. But I understand why it's important in terms of the number of doctors and the availability. And if you wait to see one particular doctor, then you may have an awful long wait.
Yeah, because I'm with a practice in Bishop's Cleeve where I live nearby. And I could see any one of any of the doctors. And I don't even know how many there are, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all lovely
yes.
and very nice.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I've got a relationship with the surgery, but not with the doctor. And even then, my relationship with the surgery is skimpy, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. And that's fine if you have straightforward complaints.
Yeah.
But interestingly, tying in with what we're talking about with mental health, for example, I think that if you have an ongoing mental health issue or ongoing chronic illness, then sometimes that relationship with an individual doctor can be very powerful and it can be very supportive.
Yeah.
And I think it's a shame, personally, that we're losing that, although I understand why it's not possible in the modern world.
Yeah, for that, in that particular aspect of health, more so than probably any other, is about mental health.
Absolutely.
Because it's quite hard to put your hand up in the first place.
It's really hard.
And go to somebody and say, I'm struggling, you know. And then the doctor needs to... You can't diagnose these things in a 10-minute session, frankly, I don't think. So, which is why sometimes it runs on and that's fine.
No. Especially when quite often it's not the presenting complaint. And so often people will come, especially men, and they don't want to come in and say, I've got a mental health issue. But sometimes it comes out during that consultation.
But that you can't get to that quickly, though.
You can't get to it quickly. And often it takes more than one consultation. It's what we classically call the hidden agenda, or often as the patient's on the way out and hand on the door handle, saying, oh, while I'm here.
Oh, God, yeah,
and
that's
often the actual cause for them being there. And that's when you invite them back in.
Does that happen a lot?
It does happen.
It
doesn't happen all the time, but it certainly regularly happens. And if you're aware of that, then it's an important.
So
it's important not to reject that offer at that point. So that while I'm here, is often the real reason. And if that is then dismissed, go and see somebody else or come back another time, then you might miss that opportunity.
Yeah, and the consequences of that could be severe.
Can be, absolutely.
So how somebody walks through the door then, and then perhaps not showing a mental health issue, and you might think, there's something behind this.
Yeah.
What sort of conversation do you have with them? Because the reason I'm asking this is because one of the reasons I've found it very difficult personally, particularly at work, which is a whole separate issue, and we'll get onto that, is feeling psychologically safe to be able to put my hand up and say, but when you're seeing a doctor, you'd think you'd be able to do that, wouldn't you? Because that's what you're there for. But actually, it sounds like it isn't. So how would you approach that?
So again, I think having that relationship initially is really important, because the safety of that consultation is really important, and it's important that you understand that where we are within those four walls is completely confidential and safe and important for you to be able to raise those issues. And sometimes it's a case of just trying to raise why you might be experiencing some symptoms. So, for example, often people will come saying, I'm having difficulty sleeping. Can I have some sleeping tablets? To which the answer is usually no. But the actual answer is, can we explore why you're having difficulty sleeping? And then you enable the patient to open up as to why there might be some underlying reasons and often they'll say, I'm absolutely fine. As long as I can get some sleep, I'll be fine. I'll be back on track again, no problem. Just give me some sleepers and I'll be back to normal. And that's never the case.
No. It's one of many things that might be going wrong.
Absolutely. So then it's exploring the other sorts of symptoms. And often then be enabling people to say, for example, sometimes people who have sleeping difficulties also have difficulties with concentration or with motivation, or sometimes they wake up in the morning still feeling tired. Have you experienced anything like that? To which they may well say, yes, but it's just because I'm not sleeping. I can't concentrate because I'm not sleeping. And then you raise some other issues and say, sometimes people even find it's difficult to, it affects their appetite, for example, or it affects how they're managing at work. And are there any difficulties or issues at home or at work? And again, that's offering an opportunity to then say, I do get some of those things. And then sometimes it's useful to use a leaflet explaining some of the symptoms of stress or anxiety or depression or burnout or whatever it
may
be.
Would you raise the subject at that point? Because some people feel it's a big weakness, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And so I wouldn't necessarily raise the word initially of either depression or anxiety in the first sentence, but I would definitely raise it in the consultation.
Right, okay.
Because I think actually having a diagnosis and making a diagnosis in mental health issues can be very powerful and quite important.
Yeah.
But if a patient's not ready to receive that diagnosis straight away, then that's very difficult. So it's often a process. And it's very much about what we call safety netting or bringing somebody back, having given them some things to think about, to then come back and say, well, yes, actually, some of what you're saying does make sense. I do recognise myself in this leaflet that you gave me. Perhaps there is something else here.
Right. So you have... Sorry, go on, Jim.
So, I mean, I will raise the topic of saying sometimes this is a sign or a symptom of somebody who's feeling a bit low or feeling a bit depressed, or indeed might have some anxiety issues. Why don't you have a read of these leaflets, then come back and see me in a couple of weeks' time, and then we can have a think about how we try to manage this going forward.
Mm. Do you give them a... At that point, would you give them a shopping list, for want of a better expression, of things that they could try to do, so, you know, about eating better, walking and all that sort of stuff?
I think that's very much part of the whole recovery process. But at that stage, in that very first consultation, I'm thinking more about the making the diagnosis. And so I don't want to jump in and make a diagnosis straight away. I'll be saying, let's confirm between us that we agree that this is the diagnosis. Otherwise, if I say, I think you're depressed, and you go away thinking, well, I'm not depressed.
They'd never go back.
I'm not going to go back and see that guy. And he's just told me to go out for a walk. That's what a waste of time that was. I wanted some sleeping tablets.
It's a really sensitive process, isn't it?
Very difficult.
I mean, incredibly
difficult. And it takes a long time sometimes. And unfortunately, these days, time is something that the NHS doesn't have.
Yeah.
And that leads us on to how we try and manage these issues sometimes, because it's very easy to say, well, we want to engage somebody with counselling, psychological therapies, that sort of thing. But if that's not available for 6 months or a year, then what do you do?
Well, what do you do?
Well, and that's a very good question. You try and support people. You try and encourage them with things that they can do for themselves. So that moves on to what you're talking about with the lifestyle things, which are key to a lot of this.
I know. I never thought they were, but
they're
my
absolutely
God, they are.
Key to this. And there are psychological reasons for that, but there are also physical and chemical and neurotransmitter reasons for that as well. A lot of depression is around cortisol and serotonin, dopamine, noradrenaline, and all these things there's a very complex interaction between those sort of neurotransmitters and hormones.
As I'm learning now, having been aware of my particular depression, I don't quite understand how they all connect together, because I think you need to be a neuroscientist for that. But understanding that these things are important, and certain things that you can do help you
out.
And
there are things that you can do yourself.
Yeah.
And that then brings in medication. And medication for some people is a very dirty word, and drugs are evil. And for other people...
They can't
put
wait.
Me on drugs and make me better.
That's almost what they're going to get.
And this
isn't
is
it?
Sometimes the issue in terms of people in business as well, I think, because partly because of the personality that we see people who are successful in business, who tend to be very driven and goal getting and problem solving, and they come in and see you and say, "Well, just make me better. I've got this. I want to be better. Give me a pill. I'll be sorted."
I can't have time off because I'm under too much pressure at work. And this is the cause of what's happening anyway.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a fascinating whole issue, I think. But the drug issue is an interesting one, because it can help. Drugs can help in terms of the imbalance in those neurotransmitters, so it can help with the symptoms. But it's not getting to the root of the cause, and it's got to be part of the issue as opposed to the only issue. So I will never start somebody on antidepressants in that first consultation. I might raise the possibility that sometimes they can be useful, but I certainly won't start them without giving them more information. And also the information about the downsides, because there are downsides about being on antidepressants.
I mean, it's interesting, because when I went to see the doctor in December 16, she put me on antidepressants there and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I thought, well, job done, you know, that's it, I'm cured, because it's not.
Yeah.
But then I read the little list of side effects.
Yeah.
You know, 1 in 10 gets depression
yeah.
because of taking the drug. And I think, well, that's something wrong there. So it's quite refreshing.
I think I would probably do it the other way around. I mean, yeah. and everybody does things in,
yes,
in different
do.
Ways. And
yes.
by no means am I saying I'm right on this. This is my personal views. This is the way I try and manage these sorts of things. But I'm more likely to give you the leaflet about the drug in the first consultation to have a think about it and a look at, and a read of those things
mm.
that you can then come back with in a couple of weeks' time and say, hang on, Jim, you've given me this, you're talking about giving me this drug that might cause all these side effects. Can we talk about that? And then at least when you go on it, the drug, you have more understanding of the pros and cons of why we're doing it.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's not going to start working straight away. It may make you feel worse for a few days. But the effects gradually start kicking in after a couple of weeks. But also that this is something that we're going to be using in the short term to make you feel better, to then enable you to do the psychological therapies and the things that you can do yourself, which is what's actually going to make you better.
Yeah. Yes. It is those things, isn't it? And sitting at home, not getting fresh air and not getting sunlight, and you know, just not good for you. Time on your phone.
Absolutely. I worry about social media and
so
young
do
people.
I. So do I. Well, you've got kids the same age as me.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It scares me to death the amount of time that they're spending on their phones.
Yeah.
I don't know what the average is, but it's hours and hours per day.
It is. And it's a worry.
We both saw people on the tube this morning, didn't we? But people just flicking through crap.
Yes, absolutely.
Why? Yeah. Why? Yeah. I don't get that.
Or playing games on the computer and the telephone, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Why don't they, you know, lift their head up?
I'm
and
all
look
for
around.
Mindfulness and for appreciating what's going on around you.
Yeah.
Although, having experienced the tube this morning, there's not an awful lot of mindfulness to be done there. But nevertheless, I think that social media and
doesn't help, does it? So how do you deal with somebody who's come in who is absolutely, you know, right from the minute, almost the minute they walk through the door, because there's something in the way their eyes look or something like that, that they are severely in a bout of depression and potentially suicidal?
Yeah, okay.
How would you deal with them?
Suicide is a very difficult issue, and it's a really important one, I think, to talk about as well, because not enough is talked about with it. And it's the highest cause of death in under 50-year-olds in men in this country, and it's staggering and frightening.
That is frightening.
And it's a difficult topic to raise, and people do get, even medical professionals find it difficult to raise that topic. But I think it's important to get it out there and enable people to tell you how low they are feeling.
Yeah.
And I'll often start by saying, how low does it get? Do you feel like running away from it all? Because often people do have those sorts of feelings.
That's a good
way of
putting it.
I just feel like jacking it all in.
Mm.
I do what's feel like
point?
That sometimes. And then, so that's my next thing. Sometimes people feel, what's the point? Or even they feel like harming themselves. Have you ever felt like that? And so gradually you can sort of bring those topics into the conversation. And if somebody is profoundly depressed like that, then that's an urgent problem. So that's not somebody that I'm going to be saying, well, go away and have a think about it and come back and see me. That's somebody who we would need to enlist the help of more secondary care psychiatric services, for example.
Almost straight away?
And what we're trying to do in... absolutely. Mm. What we're trying to do in primary care, and this is working well, is to get mental health workers coming into the practice. And so we've got a mental health specialist nurse working in our practice now who's been an absolute godsend, because she has access to all of the secondary care services that are available and a knowledge of what other support services are out there, and also the time to have a consultation with the patient specifically about their mental health issues.
Yeah.
And as time goes on and more of the mental health support workers in primary care become prescribers, because they then become able to prescribe medication if it's appropriate, then we can do more active intervention at an earlier stage, which is important. And that support of the patient is so important as well. And it's about making sure that you have finite times for them to come back for follow-up and make sure that they do come back with that follow-up.
Do you sense it's on the increase? I know you're not in... Well, you only left 3 weeks ago, but do you sense it's on the increase?
Oh, absolutely.
Is it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you think 100%. That's...
And I mean, there's some evidence that we were talking about drugs earlier on.
Yeah.
Prescriptions for antidepressants doubled in about 10 years earlier in this century. And the graph is continuing to rise. And I think partly that's because there's an increased awareness of mental health issues.
Yes.
Partly it's because drugs are better now or were better then than they had been for decades before
yes.
that. There are fewer side effects and better tolerated medications. And I'm afraid to say partly because of the access to psychological therapies, which is what people really need, isn't there on the NHS in a timely fashion. And so sometimes it becomes a kind of stopgap, as it were.
Mm.
Whereas I see it more as an adjunct to the other treatments. I often think that I often put it to patients that there's three aspects of the way we're going to try and manage this. It's situational, psychological, and medical. And
okay.
sometimes you need all of those, sometimes you need one or two of them. But the situational is there something in your life that is creating this problem?
Financial pressures.
Is there something
at
work?
Relationship pressures.
Is there something in your relationship?
Whatever,
yep. Is there something you yep. can change? Do you need some time off work, for example? That sort of thing. The psychological, which I think is the key, is counselling, psychological therapy, psychotherapy, CBT, coaching, that side of things.
Mm-hmm.
And then the medical, which may or may not be helpful in your particular case, maybe using some medication to try and help with the symptoms that you're experiencing, like difficulty with sleeping, difficulty with concentration, difficulty with motivation, that sort of thing. And sometimes people sort of buy that kind of model of how we're trying to support.
Well, you say that seems very sensible, but you wouldn't do them all at once necessarily.
No,
you might do the first two, and the medication comes later.
Absolutely.
If that's not working.
Absolutely.
Or,
well, with the way the NHS is at the moment, sometimes you have to flip that.
Yes,
and say,
you do.
Well, the medication is there to help to make you feel better. And actually, the undergoing intensive psychotherapy and counselling is very difficult and quite challenging. And
you need to
be able to concentrate to do it. So if you're so depressed that you can't concentrate long enough to actually concentrate on your counselling sessions, or indeed you don't have the motivation to phone up and make an appointment for a counselling session, then sometimes the medication can improve those symptoms, so you're then able to undertake the psychology more effectively.
Yeah, because, yes. And because for me, the medication came first, mm. right? And
how do you feel about that? How did that help or not in your particular case?
Well,
if you don't mind,
No, Christ, yeah, I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah.
I went to the doctors in December 2016 I phoned them up first because I'd cracked up at home and I was ended up crying in the lounge after a family meal and, you know, bless the family, they all thought they'd upset me individually, you know, which is lovely, actually. It was lovely to hear that.
And families are important, but before we move away from that too much, families and carers are really important.
Yes, they
so
are.
So it's important that you recognise that that was an issue.
Yeah.
But were you able to tell the doctor that mental health and stress or depression was your problem?
No, because I didn't know.
No.
Right. I explained what had happened.
Mm.
And I'd actually written down on a list, on a piece of paper, of the things that I was feeling and had been feeling for probably the last 4 years without really realising it,
sure.
which is interesting. And there was nothing on there about self-harm.
No.
Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Or suicide thoughts or anything like that. And I convinced myself that was because I didn't want my family to find the list, pick it up, read it, and see that.
So you had been experiencing those
yes.
thoughts,
yes.
But you weren't prepared
yes.
to put them down.
No.
And had somebody asked you in the consultation, how low does it get, or had you ever felt like running away, or is it worth carrying on?
Yes.
Would that have enabled you to then raise those issues?
Yes. Well, yeah. I actually raised it on the telephone
mm-hmm.
with the first doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And bless him, he was brilliant, actually, because mm-hmm. I said, look, I'm okay, you know, I know it's Christmas, so I, you know, I'm coming after Christmas. He says, no, 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 come in tomorrow morning. And this was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Come in tomorrow morning and we'll get you in to see a doctor. So I thought, oh, okay. And I, in that telephone conversation, I'd said, you know, self-harm. I didn't use the word suicide, actually, because I was slightly ashamed of using that, actually.
Yeah, I understand that.
So I used the word self-harm. I had said I haven't self-harmed, but I've been very close to it. And then if you go back to that summer, actually, I was very close to committing suicide when I was in the sea in Rio de Janeiro. And I just gave up. There was the what's the point moment. And luckily, Will and Charlie, my two boys, saved me, actually. So I had experienced it, but I was still not prepared to actually admit it. So went in to see the doctor the next day. She gave me some medication. And I mean, I joke about it now and saying, job done, that's it, I'm cured. But of course, it, you know, it bloody well wasn't.
Of course.
But I did feel a sense of relief that actually I'd got to the point where I'd started to address it. Absolutely. I didn't know what I was dealing with, but I knew there was something seriously wrong.
And somebody had listened to you and took on board your issues.
And she was really good as well, you know, in the way that she spoke to me. But she'd had a sort of head start because she didn't have to get me to speak about self-harm because I'd already said that, if you like.
Yeah.
And she did say, well, you know, how does it feel? What do you feel like? And I went through the symptoms, which are pretty much as you've said, actually, you know, about... Well, I describe it as a gravity well, a black hole.
Yes.
So once you start to slip into it, you know, you're doomed. You can't get yourself out of it. And I've now learnt after 5-6 years that actually the key to it is to stop yourself getting near it in the first place.
Absolutely.
And it's all the things that I then do. So, yeah, the doctors were incredibly supportive. And I had to go privately for therapy, which I didn't do for another... 3 years, four years.
Really?
Because I was ashamed.
That because you felt there was a stigma or something? Yeah.
And I felt I could do it myself. I felt I could do it myself.
Yeah. You know? The other thing that I often wonder about and think about is do you feel that that might have had an impact in terms of work and your environment at work and your career and that sort of thing? Because I do worry about that with patients that I see sometimes.
Yeah.
We'll sometimes see patients who don't want... If they are off sick, for example, they might say, well, can you write a sick note for something else? Because I can't say that I'm stressed or depressed because that will affect my career.
Yeah. I want to explore that particular issue later. For me, no, because it was actually leaving work that did me.
Right.
Because I, you know, I was finance director, super dry.
Yes.
Three profit warnings in short order. I get fired. Right. Mm-hmm. And so suddenly your whole sense of purpose is gone.
Indeed, yeah.
You know, you mentioned about motivation, energy, you know, all the things that you said a little earlier on. I had all of those in spades.
Yeah.
And that lasted 4 years.
And the difficulty as well is that when that's in conjunction with not having a structure to your life, so the structure of going into work and that sort of thing can be very helpful and powerful.
Yeah.
Whereas when somebody has either been fired or retires, for example, then they can be just drifting, and that can be a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah,
as well.
It is, because everybody sort of, you know, you work your socks off, get to retirement, and, you know, you go off the edge of a cliff in terms of things to do, and then you sit at home and think, well, what the hell am I going to do?
Often. Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, the way to do it is like a bell curve. You drift into it, you know, like you're doing really with your still doing your locum days and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But it's not, you know, it's not a very nice place to be when you're feeling it.
Yeah. What do you think about that aspect that I was saying about people worrying it might affect their career? Because that's something that I've thought from the other side of the desk, that people worry about that. And also in seeing... colleagues, because a big issue that I think is very important is how mental health can affect medical professionals themselves, and the stress that one is under.
If you want to work in a stressed environment,
absolutely,
Jesus.
and taking on the support and caring for people with, for example, mental health problems, takes an awful lot of your own emotional reserves, and that can be quite difficult.
Yeah.
and increasingly so these days.
But so I think you're right, Jim. I think, you know, the way work is now, I can't remember who I spoke to. They said they wanted to do capitalism 2.0. Right? So you got, if you think you've got capitalism 1.0, which is basically how it is now. So it's all about money, greed, you know, driving the business forward, working people hard, thrashing them to within an inch of their life, you know, that sort of stuff.
And despair.
I just, I'm not in it now, so I still despair for my kids. But what he said, you need a capitalism 2.0. So, yeah, business is tough. It is tough. But why don't we give the support to young people to be able to help themselves and protect themselves and look after themselves and create work environments that are amenable to that? Have permission, and this is the real crux of why I'm doing all of this, actually. Give people permission to call out bad behaviour at work, because quite often that doesn't happen. Mm. And that's the bit that I think you were sort of alluding to a little earlier on. It's the toxic cultures that you find.
And you see that in the medical profession a lot.
Even in your practice?
I'd like to think not in our practice,
well, you're
certainly
chief
in my experience. I mean, it starts in medical school sometimes, or certainly used to in my day, you have the archetypal situation of the medical student standing around the bed of the patient with the elderly white male consultant firing questions at them and belittling them in front of the patient and their peers, deliberately humiliating them often. And we all experienced that. And that's the way we all learned. And it is appalling. And I'd like to think that's not the case anymore. But that, when we went through that sort of learning process, it almost becomes ingrained as to how things are done.
Well, but you feel, don't you? I mean, the same way that you've not had experience of a big corporation as such. Mm. But that behaviour, if you get that behaviour at board level, what does it do? It filters down, because the people who are successful behave like that. Yeah. So everybody thinks, well, I've got to behave like that to be successful. Yeah.
And the other difficulty is that it's quite a hierarchical system within medicine as well, in terms of your career progression. And so often
it's very structured, isn't it?
It is structured. And even within primary care and general practice, if you are a trainee, for example, and you have difficulties with your trainer, the person you call them out to is your trainer. And so you don't.
And, of course you
and
don't.
And often because jobs are relatively short, so you might be in one particular job in a hospital, for example, for 6 months and then move on to another one.
So
people often suck it up and say, well, I'll just cope with it. And so they don't call it out.
And they get away with it.
And that's the reason it is short term.
They get away with it.
Because they worry that their career will be impacted by the old boy network of consultants who were there. And I hope I'm talking about how things used to be 20 years ago. And I hope things are changing. I know they're changing.
But I think they've got a long way to go.
I think they've got a long way to go. But I think things are an awful lot better now than they used to be. But it's about having mechanisms for whistleblowing and calling out that sort of bad behaviour.
Isn't that a nonsense, though? You call out bad behaviour to the person who's badly behaving.
Well,
I mean, who's going to have the courage
and
to do
are,
that?
There are now other structures and ways for people to manage that. But again, within a practice, for example, that can be very difficult because it's a relatively small organisation.
Yeah.
And where do you go?
Yeah, and you'd all know each other socially as much. You know, if you're working in central London, the chances are you could live 60 miles apart.
Yes.
You know, and so you don't socialise apart from your beer after work or whatever. Yeah, it's interesting. So how did you look after your staff at the practice? Did you need to?
Oh, I think we all need to. I think it's really important. And I think it's important for people to have a well-recognized way of talking about how they're coping and how they're getting on with their colleagues. And so we have an annual appraisal system. So the old 360-degree appraisal, whereby you're getting feedback on yourself from your colleagues, and you have the ability anonymously to give feedback about everybody else in the building. And that's really important because that can be quite powerful. And sometimes if one gets negative feedback from somebody, although you might feel offended initially, and this is from patients as well as colleagues. And
of course, yes, I forgot you got all your patients as well.
Absolutely. But actually, it can be really powerful, and it can show you that that perhaps there are ways that you're behaving that you might be able to do better.
Mm. Have you ever had a GP in your 30 years or whatever it is admit that they've got a mental health issue?
Yes, and I think that's really important, and it's hard for them to do that because traditionally the profession is. Because it's this vocation that one goes into and forsakes everything else in their lives, and their family goes by the board, and it's all about being the GP and supporting everybody else, and that pressure on your shoulders is hard.
But you're pushing against an open door, aren't you? Because the people who you would likely tell are in the medical profession.
Well, you'd hope so. You'd hope so. But also, you're running a business, and you don't want put more pressure on your colleagues. So, for example, you don't want to be off sick. And notoriously, doctors are terrible at taking time off when they really need time off work.
What you mean not taking time?
Yeah, they're awful, and they carry on death's door. I don't just mean with mental health problems, but
everything. Mental health, you can't see it
because there's a finite workload, and if you are ill and you've got 30 patients to see that day and there's nobody else in the surgery apart from the people who are in there, they've got to soak it up.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to do that.
Yeah.
And so
you're letting your colleagues down, basically.
You don't want to feel that you're letting your colleagues down. And of course, part of being depressed and having mental health issues is guilt. That's a huge symptom that people will often experience, and so that exacerbates the guilt.
Yes, it does.
And so that's why I'm very clear when I'm seeing patients and supporting patients through this, of saying, this is my decision. I'm telling you, you're not going into work. You're saying that the doctor signed me off sick. It's not you going off work because you just want a few days off. This is the doctor's orders, as it were.
Not faking it, but you know, because I mean, this is going to sound absolutely dreadful, but there is a mental health bandwagon, isn't there? And a lot of people, I think, I don't know, may use that as a reason for not going into work. I'm struggling with my mental health. Did you see that?
I don't think I saw that overtly. We've all got very different thresholds
how
things affect us.
In the same way, pain thresholds and so on. Yeah,
and I certainly wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want people to feel that they shouldn't come forward with any sort of mental health problems. And actually, quite often, continuing to go into work is a very supportive and powerful thing in terms of that structure that I was talking about earlier on. And if that's part of your sort of life. Coping mechanism, then actually being at work can be a good thing. So especially if the stress is external.
Yes, that's true.
So, but I think that as I say, we all have very different thresholds in terms of our resilience and how anxiety and depression
affect us. That's such a great answer. That is such a great answer to what was a really shitty question. It's brilliantly done. Because we all do have different thresholds. You're right. Yeah. I want to go back to the NHS actually, because, and I know you had a relatively short time period in there, but
what, in hospitals, you mean?
Yeah, in hospitals.
It's all the NHS.
I beg your pardon. Yeah, sorry, hospitals.
Yeah.
Hospitals. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I know a number of people who work in hospital environment, either as GPs or nurses or whatever.
Yeah.
And the pressure must be unbelievably intense when you are, you know, you're in the middle of an operation or something and you get another emergency and you get called here and there, you get phoned up for a piece of advice. And I mean, I don't know how it works, but how can we make that better? The last bit of the question is, because the behaviour that can then degenerate into because the doctors or whoever it is seriously stressed mm-hmm. and needs to get something done now, mm-hmm. yeah, that could be seen as bad behaviour on the recipient of that language.
Sure, sure. That's true. I have to say that sort of pressure and stress isn't just the domain of hospitals. It's very much the case in primary care and
yeah,
general
sorry,
practice
I didn't mean to,
as well.
I didn't mean to belittle that.
And I can certainly see where you're coming from in terms of emergency medicine and the acute emergency of of something's happened now and we must treat we must do something now
like
to save the patient.
A&E.
A&E is a good example of that. And I think part of that is about having a strong team and a team that is well trained, everybody knows what their roles are and is well supported, and also having an opportunity to debrief after something that happens. So if there is an emergency like that, it's really important to have a structure whereby there's a formal debriefing for everybody and support for everybody.
Would any bad behaviour get called out then?
Oh, it does.
Yeah, does it?
It does.
Oh, wow.
Yeah,
wow, that's good.
It does. And and this is the difficulty. When does I need something to be done now to save the patient go and get it?
Yeah. Cross over
when
into...
When does that cross into over into bullying and, oh, well, I couldn't cope with that sort of behavioural side of things, as opposed to... the stress from the surgeon, as you in the example you gave, who needs something done straight away.
Yeah, because otherwise the patient.
I don't think that is so much the issue in terms of bad behaviour. What I think is that the bad behaviour is more in terms of the more insidious, ongoing, bullying type behaviours that happen not in the acute emergency situation,
yes.
but at other times.
Yes, because there's an element of there's a bigger thing at stake here.
Sure,
and so I'm sorry,
in an emergency,
but
we've just got to crack on, and that's where having a strong team where you all trust each other, and are well trained.
And it's almost forgiven, isn't it, and accepted because everybody understands the circumstances.
Well, I guess so. And as you say, it's a long time since I've been in that environment.
But you watch Casualty.
So, difficult for me to say in that, but it's certainly in primary care, we do have emergencies as well, and people collapse and we're resuscitating patients in the surgery, for example. And again, that's about training, and it's about mutual support, and it's about a debrief afterwards.
Yeah.
And also having a sort of opportunity to, as you say, whistleblow or call out ongoing bad behaviour.
Do you think when somebody goes into the medical profession, they may not know exactly what it's like, but they get to know what it's like pretty quickly, I would think. And you can support people, you know, as much as possible. But does there ever come a time where you have to turn around to them and say, look, this is how this hospital, this is how the NHS works. You are going to get a lot of periods of severe stress, particularly in an A&E emergency.
Yeah.
Have you thought whether this is the right career for you?
That's hard to do, isn't it?
It is bloody hard to do.
It's very hard to do. And it does happen.
I mean, that must devastate the person who's probably dedicated their whole life to wanting to be a nurse or a doctor or GP or whatever.
Absolutely. And these are the situations we talked about before where you will often go from job to job to job. Almost avoiding that sort of discussion.
Yeah.
And your immediate supervisor may also avoid that type of discussion because they think, well, by the time they realise that's the situation, they're 3 months into a 6 month job, they'll be off before too long. I think that the system in general practice is much better now in that trainees are attached to a practice much earlier on in their career. And even though they're going to hospital jobs to get clinical experience elsewhere, they still have a clinical supervision from the GP they'll be working with when they're a GP trainee.
Ah.
And that works really well because you have that support and that supervision.
Yeah. And it's not permanent, is it? It's not permanent. It's not hopping from job to job as part of your career.
Exactly, you, and you still have that sort of you have that contact throughout your training. And also there are formal assessment tools that are used regularly to make sure that you are up to scratch. And part of that is attitudinal as well. So yes, I think that we are more able now to support people if they aren't in the right career.
Yeah.
The beauty of medicine, of course, is that it opens you up to lots of different types of careers. So there are different aspects of medicine which have greater or lesser acute emergency type issues, and often there is a part of medicine that would suit you better. And most people drift into the one that suits them best.
Yeah, I guess.
But if they find themselves in the wrong one, that can be really, really challenging.
Yeah, it is, and the shame of thinking I'm not succeeding here, and I'm just not good enough.
And as we said before, with the with that guilt symptom, when you're already depressed and feeling guilty and then have the shame of those sorts of feelings as well, you can get into quite a quick
vicious circle. Go away. Have you ever been feeling like that, Jim, where you're just not good enough?
Of course, I think we all do. I mean, I've had massive imposter syndrome through lots of parts of my career.
Like today.
Especially today, in front of all of this
technical equipment.
You're doing all right.
Yeah,
absolutely. I do feel that and have done throughout my career. And that's challenging.
But it's normal, isn't it?
I think it is normal. And I think a lot of aspects of mental health, we need to recognise that these things are normal.
Yeah.
Anxiety is a normal thing, and it's not necessarily an anxiety disorder as such. There's that well-recognised performance curve, the bell curve, which is over 100 years old now, whereby you need some anxiety in your life to actually perform better.
Yeah.
But it's just when it goes over the top of that bell and down the other side, it becomes troublesome.
An issue.
That's when you need that support. So these things are normal, and it's important to recognise that they can be helpful. And also, I think, I firmly believe that, and this is especially true for doctors, having gone through mental health issues and psychotherapy or psychological support
themselves,
it puts them in a better position, I think, to understand and support people who are going through it themselves as well.
Because sometimes, you know, I really struggled to get the words right to describe how I was feeling, because I just couldn't.
Yeah.
But if you are experiencing that yourself and you hear the vagaries of somebody else speaking about it in certain tones and words and so on.
Yes.
The empathy is much, much greater.
Absolutely. And that's an interesting topic. I mean, having not gone through all of that myself particularly, I do want, and this is again about sort of imposter syndrome, am I good enough sort of aspects to this? Am I using the correct language? Am I getting through to the patient? Do they think that I'm using?
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. It's not so much them talking; it's you as well. Yeah,
absolutely. And you do worry that you don't want to use inappropriate language or inappropriate analogies. I like analogies myself because I'm a simple soul and I'm quite visual.
Yeah, I know that. I've noticed that.
Yeah, and I do use. There are lots that people use in terms of mental health with a bucket sitting underneath a leaking tap, for example, and you're fine until it starts overflowing, and then everything's getting wet.
And you can't control it.
And what you try and do is you get a thimble or a cup and you try and scoop out all the water that's in this bucket, which helps a little bit, but you're struggling.
Yeah.
What you really need to do is to put a hole in the near the bottom of the bucket and put a tap in there so you can let all the water out, or you can control how you're letting the water out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But actually what's more important is repairing the leaking tap at the top so that you're not pouring all this excess water in it in the first place.
That
so
is a
that's
good analogy.
About getting I like those sorts of ways of thinking about how can we turn off that tap, which is this drip, drip, drip of the extra work it might be, or your relationship or whatever's happening in your life that is the problem.
So you're doctor, obviously. I mean, you know, by nature you have a very caring approach to life, so presumably that.
So.
Oh yeah, you do, Jim. I can tell you do. So that must transcend into the home life as well, does it? Or do you?
You'd have to ask my family about that. But I think that the difficulty As I was saying before, with this sort of vocational aspect to medicine and being a GP in particular, I think is that sometimes your focus on work can impact on other parts of your life as well.
Yeah.
Adversely, I think sometimes.
Yeah. Inevitably, you take it out on your family, don't you?
I think
you?
So, and yeah. I'm sure I'm as guilty or more guilty than most of that myself, and I regret that. And I think that the upcoming cohort of GPs, the younger GPs now, recognise that that's not an acceptable way to behave. And
yeah.
they need to recognise that their own resilience and mental health is really important.
So what do you
can't
do?
Treat and manage patients if it overwhelms you.
Yeah, or if you're in a bad space, so your judgment is
absolutely.
Perhaps
so
a bit off.
Exactly. And so you need to... A lot of this is about looking after the medical profession, because currently with the situation the NHS is in at the moment, which is an awful situation, there's a massive risk that it could implode.
Yeah.
And we need to be supporting people in that regard. And so that's partly with workload. It's partly with being clear about what is expected of the NHS, because it's very clear to me that the NHS can't provide what it used to provide.
Still bloody good when you need it.
It's fantastic when you need it. And I love the NHS, and I've loved general practice all my life. But I recognise that it's not something that is sustainable in its current form. It's underfunded. The workload issues are staggering.
I'm laughing because that's a bloody program in itself.
Well, it?
It
is.
That is a massive topic.
But the resilience of its staff is paramount here.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
if you don't
is.
Have the staff, then
It will collapse.
It will collapse. Mm. And the difficulty is there are other opportunities around the world. The world's a small place now. I know you've travelled a lot and worked elsewhere, but in the medical profession, there are places you can go and earn a great deal more in a better environment.
Yeah.
Having had the expense of being trained in this country.
Yeah. And you can understand why people would do that, can't you?
You can.
Because it is a stressful place to be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you do to look after yourself then?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think... I don't want to get too theoretical or
I'm not looking for a shopping list. What do you do? You know, do you exercise? Do you run? Do you meditate? What are the stuff you do?
So personally, for me, it's about sport. It's about keeping fit. It's about friendships and belonging to groups and that sort of thing. The theoretical bit is all about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, we've all seen these
stands the test of time, that, doesn't
it? It really does. And it's old, but it's still valid. So you do need to sort of keep healthy. I try and have a physically healthy life. But also the next bit is about safety. You need to be in a safe environment.
Yeah.
But then there's the bit about belonging and being part of a group and a team, and love and support, and that's where family comes in as well, family and friends, self-esteem and doing things that do I crave acceptance? Perhaps I do, but also that help enables you to have a bit of self-esteem and feel that you're able to do stuff yourself.
So that's your environment.
That's the sort of framework that I try what do I do myself?
Yeah.
And then hopefully that peak of the pyramid is when you can actually start achieving stuff. So I want to still have aspirations, and I want to travel and those sorts of things. I've got time. And the other thing that I think is personally speaking, very stimulating is teaching. Because I think if you've got something to give, then that's quite stimulating personally too. So that's something I want to continue to do.
So what about your mental health? Is there anything that you do in your... I saw a guy, Dr. Alex George. I don't know if you know him. He was at the Literature Festival.
He was, that's right.
And he came up with this thing called the Habit Stack. Right. So,
okay.
And I absolutely bought into it, because most, a lot of people, you know, come January the 1st, they've got their list of things they're going to do this year. By January the 15th, they've forgotten about all of them.
I've usually forgotten by January the 4th.
Yeah, that's probably, maybe I'll change that little story to January the 4th. But so what he says is don't do that. Just do one that you enjoy doing. And it takes, apparently it takes 66 days for something like that to become a habit. So you've got to stick it out until at least the middle of March, right, on that theory. And he said, once you've done that, you will do it as part of your normal everyday life. And then once you're doing that, you think, I could probably do another one. So you stack up the habits over probably 2 or 3 years. And before you know it, you're doing all sorts of things that you wouldn't normally do or couldn't stick to as part of your everyday life. So, I mean, do you do anything like that?
I'm much better at encouraging others to do things rather than doing them myself. So I'm not a good advert for my own advice. So I don't do that sort of thing, but I like the idea.
If you don't,
I think it's very good.
But you don't have to do it, you know. But
I think it's very good. And
I do.
And I do think that things like mindfulness and exercise, and as you said before, sunlight and walking and that sort of thing is really important. And I get that through sport, and I think that's an important part of it.
We are going to have a game of paddle, aren't we?
Indeed,
at some point.
Indeed.
Yeah, Jesus.
And the other thing that you talk about habits, the flip side of that is, of course, avoiding bad habits.
Yeah.
And that's something I think that is very relevant in terms of what you've been talking about with business. I think that people quite often get into quite bad habits of how they try and manage their life and their mental health in terms of alcohol and drugs and that sort of thing.
Diet.
All of that is really, really dangerous. And so it's about consciously not doing, getting into those sorts of habits.
And having
limiting
strength,
that sort of behavior.
And having the strength to do it, because it does take quite a lot, doesn't it? You know, if you're going down the pub with your mates, I'm only having 2 pints tonight, not 6.
Yeah.
You know, and they'll all go, well, you're worse, and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. So you have to have a strength of mind to be able to do that. And sometimes not everybody can do that anyway. Mm-hmm. And then you spiral down into...
And I think that's a concern when one's younger, obviously, less so now. It's more about the covert clandestine behaviours at home, for example. And it's quite easy after a stressful day at work to open a bottle of wine and then...
And before you know it.
So those are the awareness of those negative aspects is important as well, I think.
Oh, Jim, look, this has been absolutely fantastic. I've really enjoyed it. To get the perspective from the other side of the doctor's desk, if you like, has been absolutely brilliant. And I'm disappointed to hear you don't do any mindfulness, actually.
I do
mindfulness and breathing. I was so sceptical about all of it.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Honestly.
I advocate it.
Yeah, and relaxing your body, you know. It's only taken me 65 years to get to there, but anyway.
I mean, it's a pleasure to be here talking about these issues. And as I say, it's purely my personal views. I'm no expert. But equally, it is interesting to just get these things out in the open. And I think it's important, especially for men, to discuss their mental health and to recognise that it is important to talk about it.
But you say you're not an expert, but you've got a perspective that a lot of us don't have. You know, a lot of the people that have been on this show and people I meet, really, are in business, so they are on the pressurized side of business, whereas actually you're on the other side of it, seeing people who are in that pressurized side of business. So,
absolutely.
Fascinating.
Can I just ask, I mean, if we've got time,
I've got
a minute to just ask about support services within an organization, and I don't know how that's been with organizations that you've experienced, but there's organizations near us, for example, that have a psychological team and they have support within their own work environment, which I think is great. Although I have also see patients who feel unable to access that because they're concerned about confidentiality.
Yeah.
They're concerned about how that might affect their career prospects.
Yeah.
Because with the best will in the world, the therapeutic consultation will be confidential, but somebody knows that you're leaving the room for an hour to go down the corridor.
Precisely.
I just wonder if that is an issue, because I feel that that's an issue for some of my patients.
I think it depends on the individual. I mean, in my experience, there was none, right? But then
you didn't
I left.
Have that.
No, we had absolutely nothing. Yeah. Right. But then I worked in a large organisations up until, when was it, 2007 or something? And then I went into a family business, and then that grew and became what it was. But and I haven't been in business for a little while now, so it's difficult for me to answer that question. Hmm. But I'm sceptical about some of them, what some of the organisations do. So, you know, having a well-being weekend where everybody goes off and sits in a circle in a wood and so on and so on, you know, I don't know whether that works or not, or whether they're just trying to be doing the right thing. Mm. Because I do know that if I was feeling really bad with my depression, the thought of doing that would have actually tipped me over the edge. Mm-hmm. I would not want to do that at all. Mm-hmm. So it's horses for courses.
Yeah.
But you're right about the confidentiality. You know, I would never, ever have put my hand up and said I'm really struggling.
Yeah.
Because I just wouldn't, because of the fear of what that would lead to. Mm-hmm. And there was no access to psychological help, nothing. So I basically just used to go into work, sit there, grin and bear it, wait for it to pass and carry on, you know, which is not good.
No.
So I think some companies do it to tick boxes, to say that they can write it in their annual report that they're looking after their staff. Some genuinely
but
mean it,
I think
it,
if
actually.
They really mean it, it can be really important.
I think it can. But
and
I,
that leads to that open environment where employees feel able to discuss these issues.
Yeah, and I think Lee Chambers came on here, and he's a young lad, actually, very, very interesting. He's an autistic entrepreneur and has been very successful in business, and he's now doing counselling and speaking and events and all that sort of stuff about mental health. And his main thing is about creating the right work environment. So the physical environment was what he one of the things that he focused on. And you know, you think about an office generally, and it's, you know, desks all pointing each other, you know, the light shit if there is any light, you know, it might be cold or warm, it's noisy, blah, blah, you know, whatever it is. And he said, look, just try and create the right environment where people actually feel comfortable at work, so that they can do their work and relax, you know, and they're not being intruded on by anybody else and so on. And I thought, Christ, you know, that's just so easy to do without even letting the staff know that it's been done, because it will create better productivity because of it. So there's some things that you can do just by doing them, and there are other things where you think, actually, yeah, this is a very pressurized environment, I do need to look after my staff. Mm-hmm. So you provide counseling services, confidential, off-site, out of hours, where nobody knows, and you encourage people to be open about it. And I always say that, I always ask people, what's the one thing that you can do in business to create that psychological safe place for people to own up, if that's the right word? And it's very difficult to answer it. And I reckon what you need to do is get the chief executive of an organization who happens to have a mental health problem, if he does or she does, to stand up and say, I've got a vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Because what that does instantly, in the same way that the bad behavior in the NHS filters down to all the young doctors, the good behavior would do the same as well. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, you're giving permission to everybody in that organization that if they've got an issue, actually, it's okay to do this because the chief executive's done it.
And I think it's I think if it's okay, then it's less likely that people will then go off sick. And this is the thing, that people can manage when they have that support, albeit perhaps not in the same way as they were working before.
Yeah.
But that enables you to then continue because you're feeling you're getting that support. Whereas if you feel you're getting no support, you'll just say, well, I'll be off sick then.
Yeah, but you're not hiding behind anything. You're not letting things well up and store up and explode inside you. You're getting it out there as soon as you can.
Yeah, the other just quick thing I have experienced, though, is sometimes employers are better than people think they're going to be. And so there's this perception that they're not going to be listened to or supported. And this is why
say that again. I didn't understand
So if somebody has mental health issues, they often worry that the boss is not going to take that seriously or be supportive.
Yes.
Which is why they come to me saying, can you sign me off for flu or a headache? Because I don't want stress or anxiety or depression to be on my sick note. Actually,
terrible,
I find that that it, and I would never do that. I would always say it's important for us to put down why you're off, because that will often enable them to have that discussion. And that's the thing. So, and often bringing that up, sometimes just via that sick note and saying, well, this is why I'm off, will they'll then get the support that they actually need.
And the person doing it will self-reflect, hopefully.
And that's true as well. And also, often they'll say, well, yeah, we all knew that, but we didn't know how to bring it up to you. And so the fact that it's out there, we can all say, oh, yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah, floodgates are open. Yeah, I know. So it's just that getting over that stigma.
It is.
Is the hardest
talking
thing.
Talking about that is really important.
Yeah, it is. It is. Jim.
Sorry to witter on.
No, it's you have not. Fascinating. No, you haven't. I don't know
I
how long
like
that was.
I just like being in the studio. Was,
yeah, honestly, it's great, isn't it? It is. It's really good. And we've completely ignored my script, really.
Oh, sorry.
No.
We've gone off piste.
No, we've actually covered most of it, but not in the right order. But, you know, there you go. It doesn't matter. Jim, thanks ever so much.
Thank you.
Ever so much.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye.